not met him personally till about a year ago at one of our ex-Mormon, post-Mormon parties up in Seattle that I run up to occasionally. I usually hold parties two or three times a year in Portland area, and I have a couple of friends in Seattle who do it for the Eskimos up there. So he came to that, and I had been contemplating approaching him about speaking anyway, and when he came to the party, it was just like a trapped animal. He couldn't get away from me, but I'm really delighted to have him here. I've had several people tell me after finding out that he was going to be speaking at the conference that he was a significant, and he and the books that he's edited have been a significant piece of moving out of Mormonism and leaving the church. And I know there's a lot of people who are very thankful for a lot of the research that he's done and the editing and the putting together of essays. And he has written many things also for Dialogue and Sunstone, which I had read over the years, and has been a significant force for trying to get the real history and the truth out about the history of the church. The two books, and Brent is working on a new book, which I know that he will be speaking about tonight, so I'm really excited to hear about that. And I need Brent, when he gets up here, to explain something, because on his bio it says that he's a technical editor in the electronic game industry. So I need to know what that is. So without further ado, I'll turn the time over to Brent Metcalf.
Is, yeah, better? Okay. For this presentation, I'd like to kind of keep this as casual as possible while still being informative. And so my goal here, I guess, is to try and introduce you to some of the issues relating to Book of Abraham scholarship and kind of where things stand about the Book of Abraham. And so feel free to ask questions as I'm going along. Now, all of you received a handout that has probably made your eyes completely glaze over with what in the world is this, right? But I am absolutely committed that by the time you leave this room tonight, you will understand the significance of that handout, or you'll have a really good piece of scratch paper, okay, one or the other. And if I can achieve that end, I think I will have achieved a lot. Now, okay, so what qualifies me to talk about some of this stuff? Well, I've been interested in Mormon studies for a long, long time. And over two decades, well over two decades now. And I guess, way to go, Sue. I guess that it could be summed up best by a reviewer of my book, New Approaches to the Book of Mormon, that was put up on Amazon.com, where he referred to me as scholarship's answer to Elvis. And so I guess that's probably my greatest scholar or my greatest credential that I could possibly offer. I mean, that was a unique one to me. I don't know how many of you know about my background and kind of where I've come from in relationship to the LDS Church. I grew up a very faithful Latter-day Saint, still have many family and friends who are devout Mormon. My father, until he retired, was managing director of temples for the LDS Church, which is basically the person who oversees all the operation of all the temples throughout the world. And I still have family members who are employees for the church to this day. And so very, very devout family. It was in the early 80s that I became, actually while I was working for church security, that I had a really interesting job where I was basically in their dispatch unit, which was called the control center at the time. And we would work 12-hour shifts at a time, and I would just read fanatically. And I had a goal to read at least one book a day, as well as at least multiple articles a day. Most of the stuff that I read was related to biblical criticism, specifically literary and historical approaches to the Bible. And so that kind of sent me down a new path. And there was one book that I read in particular they had a remarkable impact on me. And I don't know how many of you have ever read it, but it's called The Birth of the Messiah by Raymond E. Brown. Have any of you read it? Thank you. Right. That book was literally a life-changing experience for me. Because what I discovered in that book was not that it was almost like irrespective of the accuracy of what Father Brown was talking about with regards to the birth narratives in the Bible. He showed a new way to me of looking at text that I had never perceived before. I had always thought that the way that I read text, that, you know, I was giving it the plain sense reading, you know, and it was... And he opened my eyes to a whole new world. Have you looked at the form of the text? Is it poetry? Is it prophetic? Is it apocalyptic? What are you looking at in a text? That totally changed my perspective on how I viewed text from that time forward. And it was literally a life-changing experience for me. So what I wanted to do was to basically apply those same methods that I had been reading about to Mormon scripture, fully convinced that by doing so, irrespective of the truth of what would come out, that we would all be better off because of it. Yeah. Naive, I guess, is just one way to put it. I wrote a couple of very apologetic pieces, I thought, at the time, but I still look back at them, and I'm kind of a little bit proud of them anyway, that I wrote for the Seventh-East Press, which was an off-campus newspaper down at BYU. And shortly after I wrote these pieces, Ezra Taft Benson had the paper banned from campus distribution. Now, while the other folks who had contributed were called in by their ecclesiastical leaders, I was a church employee, so I got called in by the people who were over security. And basically what resulted from that is that I was forced to resign from my job. And that's making a very long story very short, because it's, you know, when I think back on it myself, if I hadn't experienced it, I still wouldn't believe it, quite honestly. So from there, what happened is that a very decent Mormon bishop heard about my plight. And he asked if I would come and be his research assistant. He was a young Mormon bishop who showed remarkable charity to those around him. Some of you may be familiar with his name, Steve Christensen. Steve had a great deal of confidence in my ability, and he put me to work in the library, which we had ceremonially named the D.H. Roberts Library. It was located in his office building, and it was basically a conference room that was lined floor to ceiling with books. And it was my job to read books and then tell Steve about what I had read. And so we started having long conversations about Book of Mormon historicity. That was one of the first topics that came up. And during this time, after I was forced to resign, I met another person in the historical department by the name of Mark Hoffman. And Mark found out that I was working for Steve Christensen. And he knew that Steve was a wealthy businessman, very young. I mean, he was 32 years old. I look back on that now, and it was like we were all kids. You know, I was in my mid-20s. Steve was 32. You know, almost all of the principal players in the events that were about to unfold were very young. And Mark Hoffman approached me one day in the library and said, I found a document that was written by Mark.
Post on live TV. Then go to ultimatepokerchallenge.com and see how you can win a seat in one of our upcoming televised tournaments. And you can end up at one of the tables here in Las Vegas. What are you waiting for? Now's your chance to be on TV and be an ultimate poker star. It doesn't get any better than this.
And still to this day, I remember sitting outside Steve's office on the bench.
You've really accomplished a lot in your poker career. What's left?
Well, I'd like to maintain the balance of my life, and then as far as really fun stuff, I'd like to win 15 more world championships. Let's see if anybody can catch that. I'd like to write a book on how to achieve great things in life.
Mm-hmm.
There's a movie project about my life I'd like to see get made, and I'd like to have my own reality. Not much.
And I vividly remember.
Well, Glenn, you didn't set the bar too high. Let's get right back to the action.
Well,
we're down to our final four players. Hey, Vanessa, if you were one of the final four players and you were chip average with Amir Vahid being a big chip leader, what would your strategy be?
You know, I'd probably try to have too many moves, three flops, and Amir can certainly afford to make the call on these points for scenarios. I'd probably look for opportunities to exploit positions
post-flops.
Sounds like a good strategy to me.
We actually had the entire Book of Abraham collection professionally photographed. So Board, who had done the Salamander letter, came into the historical department with their approval to photograph the entire collection. So as a result of that, to this day, I've got now a full color set of the entire Book of Abraham collection, as well as scans of all the negatives that were taken from that. Now, it was in October conference, I want to say, of 1984. And one of the folks who was involved with Steve in funding the project had heard a talk by Bruce Armitage, and of course I had heard it as well, right? And that is that no active Latter-day Saint should ever be involved or participate in writing a book or publishing anything that would challenge the faith of another member. Literally within a week of that, the project was scrapped and it was gone. And at that point, I was out of work. And so as it turns out, the project was briefly picked up by another philanthropist, George Smith, and who has been remarkably generous to me over the years and kind. And then that project came to an end. And I went to work after that researching genealogical lines of various mission presidents throughout the world to try and locate rare Book of Mormons. And my employer at that time was Mark Hoffman. And that was around spring and summer of 1985. And so we all know what happened in October of 1985. And again, another life-changing experience that completely altered my view of the world and in a way that I'm not sure that I can ever grasp or bring back the youthful naivete that I once had. It was gone for me at that point. Since that time, my interest in Mormon studies has never ceased. People will ask, why in the world do you continue looking at this stuff and spending this time when you don't believe in it the way traditional Mormons believe in it? And I'll tell you right now, if you've never had the experience of reading a document and seeing something for the first time that you think somebody else hasn't seen before, and, oh my gosh, I can't believe that this is the letter that's hidden underneath this other letter, right? And I'm not talking about letter as in an epistle. I'm talking about a letter as in, you know, A versus a B, right? Then you'll never understand what motivates me. It's exhilarating. It's fascinating. Somebody once described historians as document detectives. It's true. It's what it feels like. It's the same type of adrenaline rush when you go in and look at something and you figure something out and something just like falls in front of you. I had that same experience for those of you who have read New Approaches to the Book of Mormon. My chapter in that book is on the order in which the books were dictated, right? Now, a lot of people don't know this, that after Joseph Smith loses the 116 pages, the question is, where do you pick up the dictation after that, right? What I tried to present was evidence for the idea that he actually picked up with Mosiah, and that in actual fact, part of the 116 pages was the opening chapter of Mosiah. And so he continued on with where he was at, going down through the rest of the book. Throwing I still a question mark in my mind where that fits in. And then after he finishes the book, he goes back and does First Nephi to Words of Mormon, right? Well, okay, one of these kind of document detective moments was when I discovered that there was a pattern going on in Joseph Smith's terminological usage. And that was that he switched from using the word therefore to using the word wherefore in a synonymous way, right? And I was just so intrigued with it. And actually, I found other terms where he does the same thing. So, you know, you're kind of going, why would Joseph Smith do that? Why would he, you know, so why do people change their signatures over time? I don't know the answer to that. But I do know that the phenomenon occurs. And you can literally see the full transition right in the Book of Ether, which is essentially the central point and the overall spread of the book, right? And if you go to the book of Ether and look at the number of times that he uses therefore in the first third of the book versus wherefore, then look at the second third and the last third, you'll literally see the transition occur right through that book where he's favoring the word therefore. And then slowly you go to the second third, it's a mix between the two. Then you go to the final third and it's almost exclusively the word wherefore, right? Well, then I, of course, that, okay, now I've got to come up with some type of control, right? I mean, how do I determine that this is in fact what's going on? So what I did is I started going through Joseph Smith's revelations that were dictated during the same time period. And the first time I examined them, it was a mixed bag. I could definitely see the favor towards therefore, but therefore kept showing up in some of the later sections as well, until I went back and took out the portions that were added later and the portions where he had duplicated passages from earlier revelations, where he had basically taken them and opened the new revelation with the same passage, right, that was dictated earlier, months earlier. And what happens? It's literally an exclusive transition from therefore up through the beginning of June of 1829, revelations after to 1830, exclusively the word wherefore, right? So that became my control because now those are dated, right? So now I can look at those and go, wow, you know, now I can see this unfolding. Now, so for those of you who are utterly bored with what I just got finished talking about, right? I can't describe to you why this retains my interest. For those of you who have some sense, some glimmer, some anything, right, that, wow, that's kind of interesting, then maybe you have some idea of why I continue to look at this stuff. So now going on to the Book of Abraham. I've continued my research ever since. As Sue mentioned, I published a book. I guess I need to define that term for you in a second here. I published New Approaches to the Book of Mormon in 1983. It was released in May of 1983. And one of my authors, who's a very, very gifted Hebraist, David Wright, professor of Judaic Studies and Hebrew Bible at Brandeis University, was excommunicated in April of 1994 for participation. And then I was excommunicated in December of 1993 for my participation. I was asked to recant, to renounce what I had written. When I declined, they went ahead and excommunicated me. I did go to the court because I felt like it was a rite of passage. And not going would be like missing my baptism, right? It was a feeling of, I want to see what this is about. I've heard about this all my life. I've never been to one, right? I've never sat in on one, so I just want to check this out and see what this is about. The folks who were involved were very gracious in how they approached it. I felt that it was pretty much a foregone conclusion, especially when I saw the state president sitting there with my copy with a copy of New Approaches to the Book of Mormon sitting next to him. But at the same time, it was kind of an intriguing experience. I guess that's the analytical, rational side of me, is that I found it fascinating. And I almost felt like I could stand outside the experience and watch it happening. And it was very interesting. So since that time, I've continued to publish. And I published American Apocrypha Essays on the Book of Mormon in 2002. I've also, as Sue said, published in Dialogue and Sunstone. And the Book of Abraham, during all this time, has never left my attention. It's one of the most intriguing texts, I think, that has been produced by any modern religion, at least. And part of the reason for that is because so many texts have survived. And we can look at it and start evaluating relationships between those texts. So, for example, with the Book of Mormon, all we've got is a printer's manuscript, which is still not complete, but fairly complete, and fragments, for the most part, of the original manuscript of the Book of Mormon. But with the Book of Abraham, we have multiple Book of Abraham manuscripts that contain the narrative of the Book of Abraham, but we also have another corpus of literature, the Alphabet and Grammar Project, right, which is a whole nother creature. And so now the document detective inside of me wants to know what's the relationship among the manuscripts, right? But before I get to that, Sue's question. I'm actually involved in game development. And so what I do as a profession is that I'm involved in creating games for the Xbox and Windows platforms. So that's what I'm involved with. Okay? Yeah. Yeah, that's what does deserve an applause. And my fear was if I didn't tell you right then, as I kind of saw it out of the corner of my eye, that I'd totally forget and it would never come up again. So getting back to the book of Abraham now and looking at the handout that I've given to you, there's a comment that I make in the handout which I want to explain. Oh, my apologies. We've got some extra copies, I think, up here. We've got some extra ones right here, so it should be fine. There is, how many of you are familiar with what the Book of Abraham manuscripts look like, right? Okay, so you've seen, if any of you are familiar even with Charles Larson's book, right, with Hugh Nibley's essay, The Meaning of the Kirtland Egyptian Papers, they provided, you know, basically you've got some nice pictures of what these things look like, and effectively you've got a left column or margin that contains characters, right? And then you have, to the right of that, English text. Now, there are two manuscripts that are very early. One is in the handwriting of Frederick G. Williams. One is in the handwriting of Warren Parrish. And they're very similar to each other. Now, in textual criticism, we would look at this and we would want to do a cladistic analysis, which is, by the way, borrowed from biology and so on, that term. And what that means is that you're looking at two documents, and you're not necessarily trying to say which one came first or whatever, but you're trying to say what's the relationship between them. In other words, what family do they belong to? Almost like a horizontal level, more of a horizontal type of framework. Whereas schematics, in textual criticism, which is the word that you're going to see on there in a minute, refers to basically the pedigree. So if any of you have done your genealogy like Latter-day Saints, you'll know what a pedigree chart looks like. And effectively what you would have is you would have manuscript number one going to manuscript number two, manuscript number three, and so on. And what that would mean is that at some point one of those represents an original manuscript, and then the other ones are copies that are going down in a chain of succession. What makes Joseph Smith's product particularly unique is that the copies were rarely static. In other words, the copies often included modifications, presumably by Joseph Smith. But we'll leave that as a question mark for right now, getting to the point that I'm leading to. So in the three tables that you see on the handout, for Abraham 1:6, 1:13, and 1:17, effectively what you're looking at is my reconstruction of the relationship among the manuscripts and an example of the evidence of why I believe that relationship exists. So if you look at it, you'll see Joseph Smith's dictation going down to manuscript 1A and 1B. Now, the folder numbers that you see on there, which is FLBR period, right, those are specifically the numbers that Hugh Nibley and others have used to identify the manuscripts. Okay? So if anybody is going to check this out, I don't want there to be any confusion. When he uses the term manuscript 1, right, that's my folder 1, for what I identify as manuscript 2. Okay? So, just to be clear on that. So basically what you're looking at is if you notice that when we go from manuscript 1B down to manuscript 2, what I identify as manuscript 2, then manuscript 3, you'll notice that there are changes that occur through those manuscripts. And you'll notice, even in one instance, you'll notice that there's two words crossed out, and from, right? I believe that's on table 2, if I remember correctly. Could be table 3. Right? Table 3, thank you. Right? What that is that's a didgraph. What a didgraph is that when somebody is, a scribe is going through copying a document, their eye will sometimes skip, right? So So they look down, write what they're writing, they look back up, and their eye will catch the same word or the same sequence of letters, and they'll simply copy it down again. That's one of the reasons why we know the manuscript, or we can at least be confident that manuscript number 2 is coming from manuscript 1B, is because in that case, that "and from" appears right above where the other usage of "and" is, and his eye is skipped. And so he's repeated himself. Now, that wouldn't have happened, or is far less likely, in manuscript 1A, if that were the one being copied, because they appear at opposing sides of the page. Right? So that's one of the things, one of the hints that tells a textual critic, this is probably the manuscript that this piece is coming from. Not to say that it helps too that manuscript 1B was transcribed by Warren Parrish, and so was manuscript number 2. So that's also a clue, right? So basically in that case, what you're looking at is that you're dealing with a stemmatic trajectory. Okay? So that's pedigree, going from manuscript 1B down to manuscript number 2, on to manuscript number 3, and then you'll see the last one is the times and seasons. So the question is, and this is what Hugh Nibley raised, is that he suggested the possibility that these pages where these scribes had these characters and were, you know, with the English text on the other side, that they were simply adding that stuff in, not under Joseph Smith's direction, but they were off doing their own thing to see if they could get these things to match up. But what Nibley didn't pay attention to is that the manuscript evolution from manuscript 1B down to 2, down to 3, and into the times and seasons is what produces the authoritative version that ends up in the times and seasons. In other words, if it were the scribes who were going off and doing their own thing, why in the world is it that it's that very evolutionary chain of textual manuscripts that we end up with the authoritative version in the times and seasons? That tells me, as a document detective, that Joseph Smith was intimately involved in these documents, in the creation of these documents. So what are the implications for that? Well, first and foremost, this stuff is not being translated from the Egyptian papyri. Plain and simple, they are taking the characters consecutively off the papyri fragments. Right? That's where these characters are coming from, except for a small grouping, where the whole is in the papyri, right? And the papyrus fragment. So what happens there? Invented characters are inserted. They're not Egyptian, right? And so they fill in the gap. In fact, the whole discussion on the priesthood ban on the descendants of Ham is from the gap. It's from the invented characters. That's where that whole section comes from. So that's the significance of what you're looking at there. So now comes a question. I've had some wonderful exchanges with a variety of Mormon apologists on different boards discussing these issues. One who I think is also an outstanding scholar is Brian Hoglund. He is actually being commissioned by the church to produce transcripts of all of these documents. And we've just had some wonderful exchanges, and I'm confident that Brian wants to do the best that he can in representing the content of these documents. And I'll tell you right now, it's that mutual respect that has to be fostered, in my mind, in order for us to have a constructive dialogue. If we're going to go in and just kind of bludgeon each other with, you know, Joseph Smith, you know, got this wrong or he got that wrong, maybe we're kind of missing a few things, right? And we need to kind of take a step back and say, really, what does the best evidence suggest in this direction? And I'll tell you right now, it's opened up a whole new world to friends who I consider to be friends, who are apologists and active Latter-day Saints, and who I've grown to respect, and they've grown to respect me. What used to be this barrage of attacks of anti-Mormon, false prophet, you know, everything else imaginable, has now kind of abated. In fact, they use the term critic in a friendly way now, right? In fact, I've had people write to me and say, I don't really consider you an anti-Mormon. I consider you a critic. And I'm like, that's cool. Yeah, you know, I can go with that, you know. So that's a huge lesson to be learned. And that, and one other thing is that in one of my recent exchanges, the question was raised to me very, very bluntly. Why don't you provide evidence that proves that Joseph Smith was a fraud? You know, after all these years, that question is so irrelevant to me in a conversation that it's hard for me to even address it anymore. It's like, if you want me to say, did Joseph Smith translate the papyri accurately? No, I don't think he did. Right? In fact, I'm really confident that he didn't. But if you want me to start making these claims about, you know, he was a conscious fraud who did this and that, I couldn't care less. That's for you to work out. Right? Been there, done that, and I'm not going to go down that path over and over again. I've already dealt with it myself, right? I know where I've come to in my views about things. And I recognize that everybody else in this room has their own journey to go through, right? I mean, I don't know who all of you are. I don't know your histories. You know a little bit of mine, you know. But I think that it's important that through all of this, that we do come to an understanding that people's beliefs will differ from our own. And that what matters, if we want to have a dialogue with people who think differently than we do, is to focus in on what is sound reasoning, what is good argumentation, and focus on those details rather than getting caught up in the semantics of who's a fraud, who isn't a fraud, because people will get a clue, right? They can understand that 1 + 1 = 2. You don't need to tell them, right? You give them the one and the plus one, they'll figure out what the rest is. Okay? Anyway, time for questions. I appreciate you letting me come tonight. This is the first time that I've been to your conference, and I've met some wonderful people. And I hope that here will for years to come. And thank you so much for letting me ramble for how long now. Thank you.
Question. I think I can talk loud enough. Okay. In all the discussions about the Book of Abraham, I have not yet come across any Mormon apologist who explains how Joseph Smith, being a divinely inspired translator, seemed to be completely unaware of what the Egyptian hieroglyphics actually said, namely that they were breathing permit for.
Well, probably the most common response to that is to argue that on the breathing permit, that the final portion of the breathing permit, and remember, it goes from right to left, right? So facsimile number one, which is vignette one of the breathing permit of Hor, is the opening scene. And then you have the contiguous pieces of papyrus fragments that follow after that, from which they're taking those characters and putting them in these manuscripts that I was just telling you about. We don't have the section that would have included facsimile number 3. Now, we know that it comes from that papyrus because we can see Hor's name is still preserved, even in the woodcut, right? So we know that it belonged to that, but we don't have it. So one of the more common explanations that I've heard is that that papyrus was much longer, and it included a segment that actually was the Book of Abraham. Now, there are numerous difficulties with that, right? The evidence that was presented for the longer papyrus was initially argued by John Gee, where he argued that the average length of a Ptolemaic papyrus scroll was X number of feet long. And he said, well, clearly, Hor's breathing permit, if we add on the section that had facsimile number 3, would be much shorter than that. Therefore, something's missing. But the problem with that, it was brought out by actually one of John Gee's previous professors, who is also an Egyptologist, is that what John Gee was talking about was the average length of a blank scroll. So in other words, they would take these blank scrolls and they would chop them up and turn them into books, right? Like the breathing permit of Hor. So in other words, we're talking apples and oranges. This isn't even analogous in that sense. Then there's the other problem, which is no small problem to me, is that when you go through the English manuscripts that have the characters going down the columns, they're all coming from the breathing permit of Hor, the known breathing permit of Hor. Not from a missing document, right? But they're coming from that document. That's just, you know, an inkling of some of the problems with that model.
I actually have a question of the dating of the papyri itself. Is it a correct assumption it was 2000 BC?
No, 250 BC, I believe.
Which what?
250.
250, BC. Which would be much later than the time of Abraham, correct?
Yeah. Depending on what chronology you go with, it could be thousands of years later. And the dating of that, it's really quite fascinating. Mark Conant, he's a Dutch Egyptologist, has done a tremendous amount of work on this. And he's actually discovered the tombs of Hor and his family. Hor was a priest in Egypt. So we actually know quite a bit about the guy that this stuff was buried with. And from an Egyptological standpoint, this document is pretty freaking impressive because it's the earliest known book of breathings, right? So Egyptologists look at this and go, oh, what a gold mine. Nothing to do with Abraham, but what a gold mine, right? Right? So, yeah.
I talked to you a little bit about it in the hall, but would you be comfortable telling us a little bit about what the current apologetic stuff was at FAIR regarding the Book of Abraham and then maybe a response to that?
Sure. Brian Hoglund, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Brian has been very gracious, and we've had a number of email exchanges, and it was really interesting because I met Brian at the FAIR conference, and we both kind of spotted each other, and as it turns out, he was talking to a mutual friend, and so I went up, and that kind of turned into a conversation, and then I kind of started right off with a question to Brian about basically what type of transcript he was going to use. Was it going to be a typographic facsimile? Was it going to be a diplomatic transcript? And I just kind of launched right into a discussion that a text critic would understand, right? But a lot of lay folks may not. And that was because I just wanted to see kind of where we were at with things. Without missing a beat, Brian just popped right back, and we literally talked for almost 2 hours nonstop from that point on, just talking about the manuscripts in detail, going over item after item, what he had discovered, what I had discovered, mutual discoveries, right? Manuscript 1A, if you go back and read Nibley's article, The Meaning of the Kirtland Egyptian Papers, it's attributed to William W. Phelps, right? Because Dean Jesse had identified William W. Phelps as the scribe, right? 2000, this is last 2000, a friend of mine, Ed Ashmont, questioned that and said, I don't think that's who it is. I'm thinking it's Frederick G. Williams, right? So I went through, and I literally went through the Kirtland Revelation book, all of Joseph Smith's diaries where Frederick G. Williams had written stuff. I even mapped out the evolution of Frederick G. Williams' handwriting from the early 1830s up to 1835. Right? To pin this down, to say, is this really who we're looking at? And I'm absolutely convinced that that's who it is. Well, about 6 months ago, completely independent of the work that Ed and I had already done, Brian came to the same conclusion, that it was Frederick G. Williams, right? Look for those common grounds. They're not always plentiful. And so when you do have them, use them to discuss other things. And so we did. And it was a very fruitful discussion, I think. And as a result of that, Brian was extremely complimentary to me in the course of his presentation. Brian and I still have real disagreements over real issues. I think that those are things that will unfold and become clear over time. We haven't had a chance to work through all those things yet. And trying to do it on an online message board is not always the best place to do it, as all of you know. By the way, FAIR was gracious enough to actually create a thread where Brian and I were the only two participants, and we were going back and forth on these issues, right? We didn't get very far, unfortunately. And now the thread's gone, so it's got pulled for a variety of reasons.
I'd like to ask, have you ever considered the Book of Mormon and the Book of Abraham and so forth, just as literature? Forget about whether it's divine or anything else like that. Do you think it has literary value, that the stories are meaningful? And
That's a really, really good question. I am interested in looking at Joseph Smith's text as creative narrative. Whether or not I would say the stories have meaning, that's for everyone else to decide, right? We were just talking at our table a little bit earlier about the story with the submarine-like vessels, right, in the Book of Ether. And if you choose to derive meaning from that, great. You know, it doesn't make sense to me the way they're described, but that's just me. So,
Brent, has the church ever published a copy of the Egyptian alphabet and grammar?
No, nor of the Book of Abraham manuscripts. And let me clarify. You basically, if I could lump it into three bodies of documents in the Book of Abraham collection, consider the papyri and related fragments one lump. And that includes, I would throw in with that, also the 19th century facsimiles, where in some cases they've actually preserved some of the characters for papyri that we no longer have, right? So consider that one lump. And then you have basically the alphabet and grammar project, which I would include multiple documents in that grouping, including the bound grammar and alphabet of the Egyptian language, three documents that were almost certainly dictated simultaneously. One, by the way, is in Joseph Smith's handwriting called the Egyptian Alphabet. Then there's another one, an Egyptian counting document, which is a really amazing document. The Egyptian characters literally look like the numbers in some cases, right? So 10 is like kind of this funny line coming down that goes over and then has a O next to it, and it's like, wow, that's a 10. You know? So that would be all included in that. And then you have the Book of Abraham manuscripts, which would be the four manuscripts that are mentioned in the handout. But no, those have not been published. Portions of the papyri are now being published, which I think is absolutely awesome. If those of you who haven't seen the posthumous reprint of Hugh Nibley's Message of the Joseph Smith Papyri, right? It's worth it just for the photographs of the papyri, because those are completely new, right? And, you know, to me, it was worth it just to buy it for that. Not for much of anything else, but for that. Yeah. Larson's photographs, I don't know the history of them, but from what I can tell, they're pretty good. Are they as good as the one in the Nibley book? In the Nibley book, the benefit is that from what I can tell, and I'm not sure how they created the images that they have, but they look like scans to me. And the reason why I say that is because the actual texture of the papyri is visible in the image. And so, for most people, they may not care. For an Egyptologist, they would find that fascinating, right? For me, I like collecting as many of the photographs as I can get my hands on. So, you know, it was worth it. You know. Yeah, please. Q-Nibley is a bit of a quandary to me. I actually started to publish a piece on the web talking about Q-Nibley. And part of it was a response to my own discovery, going back years now as a young returned missionary and looking up some of the sources that Nibley talked about and just going, wow, this is so problematic. And in some cases, just wrong, pure and simple. One of the instances that I bring up is in a couple of texts that he quotes from these manuscripts that I've been talking about in the handout. He absolutely brutalizes the text. I mean, it barely resembles what is actually in the document. But he actually makes an argument based on his misreading of the text or whatever it is. He actually makes an argument based on that and says, we know that this text here cannot be the final document because it doesn't match what's in the Times and Seasons. He's dead wrong. In the manuscripts, they're virtually identical to what's in the Times and Seasons. How was that mistake made? Maybe he took down notes at some point, came back to him later, thought he had written out the full text. Maybe he had a research assistant who had helped him, who took down notes, and he just took it as the full text. Whatever the case is, somebody didn't double-check their sources when they went to print. And so at some point, you have to be held accountable for that. Now, I would not even remotely claim to have the type of knowledge that Hugh Nibley had about the world. But I can say this, on the things where my knowledge does overlap with Hugh Nibley, he was wrong in numerous instances. I can at least say that much. Whoa, which part? that's huge. Wow. I don't know that I could point to anything, even from a naturalistic perspective, which is how I approach the Book of Abraham. I've looked at it and I've tried to say, what are possible things where Joseph Smith could have been influenced by outside sources. Joseph Smith has never come across to me as somebody who would sit down and pore over texts, trying to read them and go, oh, let's see, I'll take this part here and put it over here. The Bible happened to be, fortuitous, right? Because if you read, for example, there's a letter by Lucy Mack Smith from the early 1830s. My gosh, you can reconstruct huge portions of this thing from quotes from the Bible. That's mom, right? This is the household that he grew up in, right? This is what he's hearing all the time. So with the Book of Abraham, when I got to that, there are some things that I do find quite intriguing. One of them would be the potential influence of Josephus. Now, how that came to Joseph Smith is a whole different issue. Because don't forget, one of his scribes was Oliver Cowdery for the Book of Abraham, right? Or at least for the Alphabet and Grammar Project. Well, who quotes Josephus to interpret the papyri in The Messenger and Advocate? Oliver Cowdery does. Well, so now why would we want to tie any of that together? Well, for one thing, Josephus talks about Abraham teaching astronomy to the Egyptians. That's an extra biblical tradition. It's not found in the Bible. It is found in Josephus. The name Egyptus also appears, though in this case as a male, as the founder of Egypt. And probably, I would say, some of the more intriguing things to me is that in the Grammar and Alphabet Project, he actually gives the name for Egypt is Amastra, and the Egyptians is Amastrans, right? The name of God in the Alphabet and Grammar Project is Amun. But what's intriguing is that in Josephus, the name for Egypt is Mestra, and the name of the Egyptians are Mestrans, right? That is not widely published. I've scoured through commentary after commentary, and even the commentators who use that terminology to refer to Egypt and the Egyptians refer it back to Josephus in every text. So now we have Amastra, Mestra, Amastrans, Mestrans, right? Coincidence, maybe? Yeah, please.
I have two questions. One was, I was at Barnes & Noble not too long ago, and there was a book on the shelf that was very interesting to me, and what it was a translation of the Book of Breathings, the Egyptian Book of Breathings, and what they had is the Egyptian and the translation as they understand it, the complete Book of Breathings that you can get in English at Barnes & Noble.
Right.
And you said that this was maybe one of the earliest publications, creations of a Book of Breathings that archaeologists have found.
Extant, correct.
How does that compare with the later editions? Is this close word for word to what the one that I would find at Barnes and Noble's would be or not?
Well, here's one of the favorite apologetics, right? This one is unique, right?
It really is. That's what I'm asking.
Yes, but guess what? So is every one of them.
How
no two of them are identical.
How different are each one of them? How much different is this from the average one?
They can change vastly at times.
Second question was, my understanding of what you're saying here was that indeed Joseph Smith took part in the Egyptian alphabet and grammar, where he put one side of the paper, he put the symbol, and the other side of the paper, he put the interpretation. I've heard apologists from farms say that this was not Joseph Smith who did this. Who this was this was later followers who did their own independent project trying to figure out how to understand Egyptian by using Joseph Smith's inspiration as their guide to crack the language of Egyptian.
Right.
And now you're telling me that that was not other people. That was Joseph Smith himself who wrote that.
Yeah, it dictated initially, and then copies were created after. And we're talking about the Book of Abraham manuscripts here to separate that out from the Grammar and Alphabet Project. But I want to come back to that one, too. So with the Book of Abraham manuscripts, yeah, I believe that the origin of those belongs to Joseph Smith, right? As does the copies, right? Because he's modifying them. With each iteration, new changes are being made. And like I said, from the handout, that's what becomes the authoritative text. So if we assume then that these documents were created kind of on the whim of his scribes and so on, then we have to say that he adopted what his scribes were doing, because that's what we end up with. That's the final. Yeah. Either way, that's why I said that we can be confident of Joseph Smith's intimate involvement in the creation of these documents, because that's what becomes the authoritative text. Right? Can't get away from it. But one more quick comment on the Alphabet and Grammar Project. Remember I mentioned that there were three documents that have the appearance of being dictated simultaneously. Well, one of them isn't really being taken from dictation, because it's actually in the handwriting of Joseph Smith, right? So you can't divorce him from the project. You just cannot do it. One of these documents is in his handwriting, and when they get to the end of the other two documents, which is where you have William W. Phelps and Oliver Cowdery are also recording this, they start making changes, and Cowdery comes over to Joseph Smith's document and makes the corrections for him. So the corrections at the bottom of the document are in Cowdery's handwriting now. And so who's orchestrating this? They're not just pulling this out of nowhere, right? Anyway, please. I think 200 to 250 BC, if I remember correctly, is what they've been.
Well, okay, but I yeah. Later.
Originally they were dated closer to the advent of Christ, right?
It was Chicago, and the other one, the word Egypt, which was the color of the land, but his question was, why did it take us so much time? They did the Mormons, right? The Mormons, so much after this implied.
No, I don't think so. Let me explain why. With the Book of Abraham, first off, one of the things that he gets involved with is the Grammar and Alphabet Project, right? Now, we have some idea that there was discussion at some level about an alphabet relating to the Book of Mormon very early on, right? And there are some documents, you know, that suggests this relating to Martin Harris's visit to Charles Anton and Mitchell and so on. So with the Book of Abraham, he works on the Alphabet and Grammar Project, and that consumes a certain amount of time. But the actual time that he's spending translating for the text of the Book of Abraham is relatively short. In fact, from my accounting, he actually has transcribed up to chapter 2, verse 18, by the end of 1835, right? And this is only taking place over a few days. From then until 1842, he does nothing on it. Then in March of 1842, it's now been prepared for publication. If you notice, the first installment in the Times and Seasons ends at chapter 2, verse 18, which is where manuscript number 2 ends. And in manuscript number 3, which is Willard Richards' copy that he's preparing for the Times and Seasons typesetters, when you hit to chapter 2, verse 18, there's a blank at the bottom of this page, right? So he's now finished copying the other manuscript. So there are only 2 days mentioned after that that Joseph Smith is engaged in translation. That's the rest of the Book of Abraham, through to the end, right? And facsimile number 2 and facsimile number 3 were most likely also interpreted during that time period. So 2 day period, basically. Yes. That's a really interesting question. There are at least, you know, 2 sources come immediately to mind. One I believe is from Wilford Woodruff. I believe that the other one is from Parley P. Pratt, that mention the use of a seer stone in the dictation of the Book of Abraham. I use dictation, neutral term. Translation doesn't work for me, you know, for a variety of reasons. So I often refer to it as a dictation. But I don't know of any really sound evidence that that's what Smith was doing at the time. I don't think he would have been opposed to that. You know, it's just that there were a variety of models of revelation that were unfolding. Once the Book of Mormon's out and he's getting the initial revelations through the stone, we go to the new translation of the Bible. That's a whole nother model, right, of translating, you know. And it's kind of like one model after another as you're going down, and the Book of Abraham is simply another one in that chain of events. So anyway, thank you very much.
A quick question. I know you're not all coffee drinkers, but how many tables did not get coffee?